We're the chosen few, and we're going to be talking about better brochures, bulletins, and newsletters, which is a way of talking about how to improve written communications in general. And I work for a fundraising firm, and I spend a lot of my time with designers and copywriters, people who write letters and newsletters. So I've had the good experience of working with people who know a lot about this. And I have copies of our newsletter from Mal Warwick, which you can critique if you want later on. You can pick up a copy. Also a copy of New Ministries, a newsletter with which I'm associated. And if you want to keep getting New Ministries, there's a sign-up sheet. What I'd like to do is spend the first 20 minutes or so going over some principles about brochures, bulletins, and newsletters. And then I'd like to take the last time, just some hands-on stuff to get your reaction to these different pieces that I picked up just wandering around the village, picking up things. And we can see whether or not all this highfalutin stuff that I've said has any applicability to anything. What I'd like to first do is draw you another picture. Those of you've been around know that I love the pictures. A way to think about written communications, especially communications which are persuasive as opposed to what Walt is doing next door. And the picture that I've used as I work with folks is the radar scope. I don't know if any of you stay up and watch the old World War II movies where you have the periscope and you can see the target, if you will. And in any brochure, bulletin, newsletter, any form of written communication, there are four decisions that one makes. First of all, you decide what your format is going to be, and we'll talk about that before. What's the style going to be? What tone are you going to set? The third decision one makes is the design. What's the visual look going to be? And finally, the decision is the actual content of the publication. And the reason that the radar scope is so important, I think, is that what ties all of these pieces together is the audience and purpose. What that means is that there are some things that are outside the radar scope. It may be that if your audience is the group of people here at Holden Village, a 16-page glossy magazine with lots of color photographs is not inside the radar scope. And normally what this says is that the larger your audience and the larger your purpose, the more encompassing your format must be, the more varied your design must be, the more general your style or tone must be, and the broader your content must be. The more narrow your audience and purpose, you can get away with a smaller format, etc. Let's think about this practically. If your audience is your mother, your format can be a little postcard. Your style doesn't matter what your style is. You're writing mom, she doesn't care whether you use Old English, Middle English, or whatever. The design can be very simple, namely just a letter or a postcard home. And the content can be very limited. Mothers like to hear about the most insignificant items. And they don't have to hear much, anything. Is nice. Those of us who have children at college, any word would be appreciated. We'd have to have life story. So that's the way I've come to think about that. Well, this is a pretty general definition, that audience and purpose. I want to ask when I work with people who are writing in design, I ask them to think both about the audience and the purpose of the publication, but I also put them through another pace. And it's a process that I've come to appreciate a great deal. Where I work, we call it the marketing concept. Some people call it the creative concept. David Ogilvy, who is the granddaddy of modern advertising, calls it the big idea. And it's also called the readership hypothesis. What that is how do you bring audience and purpose together? I want to tell you my life story, or as Walt said, I want to come downstairs and tell you my dream. What's the problem? No one's interested in my dream. My purpose is to tell my dream, but it has no connection with the audience. The marketing concept says, in the market or audience, what's the concept that's going to bring the information, the news, the whatever you have, that's going to bring it and exchange it with the reader? What benefit is it to the reader? When we work with creative folks, we ask them, we don't ask them. We tell them they have to be able to say that in one sentence. It can be a long sentence. When you think about the reader, the hypothesis is, why would the reader want to read about this? Why would someone want to read a publication of the Justice Network in the Lutheran Church? What's a marketing concept or a readership hypothesis? Why? Okay. Okay. Often we're assuming what's important about this readership hypothesis is that we use signals and symbols that immediately connect. The best one I know about is when you go to a bookstore. The mystery books are never with the general fiction. They're always by themselves. And most mystery books identify themselves right away as a mystery on the cover, because they're saying, this is the readership hypothesis. I want to reach readers who enjoy mystery, and if you enjoy mystery, you want to read this book. And what Than was just saying is, this is justice. And there are some people who are interested in justice. Any questions about this? This is the hardest part, I think, of any publication process. It's very easy to say, I've got something I want to say. I really have to get it out. It's really important. People must know this. But then the next question is, why must they know it? What benefit is it going to be to them? And how do I target those who will most benefit? This is the Holden newsletter. I think that there's a creative concept or a marketing hypothesis here. What do you think it is? Whom are they trying to reach? People who've been here and people who like the outdoors. Here, a photograph was used as the creative concept, whether intuitively or consciously, I don't know which. It said, this is what Holden is.
Mostly people who have been here like the outdoors.
Yeah, right. Yep. Holden, which they know, and then this reminds them that, yes, that's the reason. Okay. Well, let's just go through and talk about what kind of formats are there? why would you choose one as opposed to another?
Does anybody know what this format is called?
Tabloid.
It's the cheapest way to put ink on paper in quantities usually above 2 or 3,000. It depends on the printer. But it's a very inexpensive way to print in quantity. It's all printed together and then cut and folded. And most of the time it comes off the press, off of a web press, just like this, already done. So that's why it's so inexpensive. And it's printed on usually on newsprint, although it can be printed on other paper. And a web press is a press that's like a web, and it prints everything all at once. So this is called a tabloid. What's this? What format's this? Newsletter? 8.5 by 11. Here, this is 8 pages. No, actually, it's on the verge of becoming a magazine. Most newsletters are just 8 to, although the Bread for the World's new newsletter, I think, is, this is printed on 11 by 17, which is a standard sheet of paper that almost every printer can run. Even photocopiers now can, most photocopiers can run 11 by 17. I think that's the largest size that the press over here can run. I don't, maybe not. What is this? The brochure, right? And it's on 8.5 by 14, which is an odd size, but is not that, it's cut out of 8.5, as you can tell, 11 by 17 is 2 8.5 by 11 sheets, so this is a little bit larger. And it's folded this way. It could have been folded lots of different ways, but it's folded this way for a variety of reasons. Let's see if we've got anything else here. Here's a little ELCA Hunger Program. This is like a mini booklet, another format. Let's see if I can find anything else. I guess not. Here's a good one. Here's just one sheet. City Lutherans in Action. It's not really a brochure. What these are usually called is information sheets. A very inexpensive way to do it. Here's another brochure. Some of the other formats that are very useful are news releases. Do any of you send out news releases? News releases are one of the most read items. And so maybe I'll take just a minute. The first thing on a news release is the date and contact person. And then the subject, topic, or headline, whatever you want to say. And then usually the place, which would be Chelan, Washington. And there's a news release. And normally news releases are one page. Sometimes they're 2 pages, but most editors only read one page. Well, why do I tell you that? Because this is a way to get published in newsletters, newspapers, magazines, etc. But I think it's also a very interesting way to communicate with your very best friends of any organization. It's John, is that correct?
John,
which organization are you with?
Well, right now I'm with a community blood bank in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Okay. So if you want to get your best blood bank donors, send them a news release instead of a newsletter. What if there's a special blood bank? They're very easy to do, they're very inexpensive, and everybody is interested in news.
So you'd send them the same news release that you would send also to the media?
Yeah, why not?
Mm-hmm. I've never thought about doing that.
I think it's a very effective, normally I have what you call a VIP list, which includes your board members, your major donors, your favorite publishers, what the whole list of poobahs and
unless special. Unless they'll think that they're in kind of on the inner circle.
Yeah.
No, in my case, you wouldn't send this to your entire donor list, which
no.
is around 17,000 people.
No. Although, from time to time, we've sent news releases.
Yeah, we do. Just, every year, at least, we send out a newsletter that goes to every
So let's see if there are any others. There are posters. I think there are some around here, a very effective way. There are bulletins, worship bulletins. There are magazines. We talked about that. And there are letters. One of the most effective ways to communicate with people are letters because they are, by their nature, personal. Well, any other formats or questions about which formats are best?
In those news releases, would they have to be sent in an envelope, or could they be sent out kind of like a newsletter, just folded them?
They should almost always go in a news in an envelope. Yeah, and often it says, you know, on the outside it will either even say news release or for immediate release, etc., or sometimes just news. Any other questions about formats? Which formats are best for which situations? Which are the what's the best format to raise money with?
A letter.
A letter. Because it's the most personal, and money is the most personal. Tabloids are best for news. Newsletters are best for news that's not as newsy. I mean, it's sort of a contradiction in term. Brochures are best for just general use that's going to be repeated. Here's an information sheet about Rainbow on the Mountain. It's not really a brochure. It's more of a information sheet. It's not quite a newsletter. Okay. Remember our little quadrant here. We talk about format. Let's talk next about style. The concept that we work with all the time is called readability. And advertising firms, newspapers, etc., have some standards of readability, and they will run copy or they'll run articles through this test to see whether or not it's readable. And there are even some computer programs that will do that for you. But readability in general is made up of two things. One is ease of reading plus human interest. The first one is pretty simple to define. Ease of reading. What makes it easy to read things? Just in terms of the way you write. What's the single most critical thing in determining ease of reading?
You mean in the words themselves?
Mm-hmm. When you're writing an essay, or writing a newsletter, or writing a letter to somebody, or doing a worship bulletin.
Simple, I guess.
Okay. Simple. And simple has short sentences.
Short words rather than long words, I guess.
Short words. Okay. This really has to do with human interest. But it's very important. What else makes simple sentences? Short words,
short paragraphs.
Short paragraphs.
I also think the layout has a lot to do with the
reading. Yes.
How much space, how long the lines are,
right.
How much space between the paragraphs.
Right. Okay.
Systematic.
Okay. We'll not lose those ideas here.
I'm still here. Simple sentence structure. Which means that there's a subject, a verb, and something that's being acted on if it's a, it has an object. Most often when people write, they've learned to use a very convoluted style. Although I'm here to talk to you about bulletins and brochures, I'd also like to talk to you about what happened in that process. You had to hold that first thought in suspension, sort of hold it up there, try to keep it in your short-term memory bank to see where in the world I was going to be. If you want to have a simple sentence structure, if you want to have ease of reading, the other way to do that would be, I'm here to talk to you about brochures, bulletins, and newsletters. And I want to talk to you about. So the difference between those two is very dramatic in terms of making it easy to read. Some of the other things that you alluded to are these personal pronouns, which is really the conversational tone of voice that all of us use. For some reason, it is easier to read conversation than it is to read abstract thought. And so the closer that your writing gets to speaking, we make our copywriters read their stuff aloud after they've written it, because that's the best way to find out some of the other things that trip up reading. In addition to short words, there's a whole category of words that are called Latinate. Those are words that are of Latin derivation. They often have a shun on them, like demonstration and all those other words that are based in our Latin voice. And if you read, they're also very hard to pronounce. And so you avoid words that you can't pronounce. If you can't, our rule of thumb is if you can't pronounce it, don't put it down, because most people still are listening to the words as they read. And so if you want to have ease of reading, you avoid words that you can't pronounce. Anything else that makes style easy to read?
I think you can avoid using unnecessary words. You know,
right. Very good.
A lot of words to a sentence without adding any additional thought.
Yes. It is one of the paradoxes, one of the contraries, if you will, that by modifying a word, we weaken the word. I am very, very interested in speaking to you. Interestingly enough, that is much weaker in saying, I'm interested in talking to you. A word by itself is much more powerful without an adjective or an adverb. So one of the simple things that you can go through and is just cross out all the adverbs and adjectives and see if it still works. If it does, just leave them out. We even count words per sentence, and we look for 11 to 14 words as the maximum. Most people can't hold more of a thought than that. It helps if you have some variety, because some should have 6 and some should have 16 or 18, just to add variety to your prose. Any other things that make it easy to read?
Proper punctuation helps.
Yes.
If there's a comma missing, then you have to reread the sentence.
Right.
Figure out what it's saying.
Right. And it really helps if you don't use very many commas at all.
Yeah, keep it simple.
And
it's still proper.
Right. And we do lots of 4-page letters. And another rule of thumb that we have is that you get 1 semicolon per letter. That you should be able to avoid using those. One of the trickiest things in writing, remember that the things I'm talking about are things that people are reading because they want information, because you want them to take some sort of action. And one of the hardest words in the English language is the word no. And if possible, you should always rewrite sentences to use a positive expression rather than a negative. I'll give you an example. Negatives always confuse people. If I said, people can't understand negatives,
it's much more difficult for you to understand my second sentence than my first sentence. About 80% of the time, most people will not read a negative thought. They will assume that it's positive, the comprehension tests that are given. For some reason, our mind is not very good at negating. Think about it. How do you create the absence of something? That's a very difficult concept. Anything else that...
I was thinking about transitions and some kind of pattern of thought, so that a person
yes.
knows where you're going and where you come from.
Uh-huh.
So they have a big picture when they're done, rather than a lot of things scrambling around.
Okay. Yeah, I think... that there's some sort of sequence of ideas, and that there are some transitions to signal those sequences. Again, because we're writing informally and we're writing in a natural tone of voice, which is the easiest to read, using transitions like so and that and then, that's, when. There are all sorts of temporal and conjunctive, they're called conjunctions, transitions that are helpful. But is another great one. Because but always says, well, this is a change of idea. Okay.
Now, I've heard something said about but, where what that does is negate the first part of the sentence. And there you have your no in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You make a statement, and then you have a but, and then the person will forget the first statement.
I think that can happen sometimes. It depends on where it is. If it's a new paragraph, I think that's not the case. If we're using John's concern about transitions and sequence, I think it's much more effective there. Mm-hmm. But I would agree with you in general.
Mm-hmm.
We love the word and at Mal Warwick and Associates. We think it's one of the greatest things
mm-hmm.
going. Because what you're really doing is just adding thoughts on top of other thoughts.
Right.
And hoping that the reader can hold as many of them as possible. Okay. Well, how do we get to this human interest business? Remember, we said that nobody's going to read your publication unless it has some interest or value to them. We listed personal pronouns. What are those?
I feel like you is
you a lot. Yes. Some.
We.
Yeah. We. A little less personal, but important to use. Some advertisers say that a headline won't work unless it has you in it. You can save $10 by, so that pulls that up. What other ways do we get a human interest?
Well, you already mentioned the conversational style.
Conversational. And the best example of that are to use quotes from people. Instead of saying, Susan told us all about her trip to the Near East. We could say, Susan said, I've just gotten back from the Near East and it's the most fun I've ever had, end close quote. That's going to be much more interesting to me as another human being because I can hear you talking. The other way is to tell stories, as we can hear next door, to use examples.
Use humor.
Humor? Good. Very good. Description. Specifics. Holden is a wonderful place. No, Holden has mountains that are covered with pine trees. I mean, And again, you can be even much more specific about that. But the more specific and descriptive it is, the more we can envision it, the more human interest that it has. Anything else that increases human interest? So that you use a comparison to their situation. Okay. The other thing that's used, and some of you may have read Mark Twain, which was one of the devices he used all the time, is one of the things that we're all interested in is time and the passage of time. We immediately get engaged in that as part of the storytelling device, but it's also just the passage of time.
This would just be human interest now, not negotiating, not trying to get their attention by being on their side.
Say some more.
Okay, I guess I'm thinking of if I want to convince someone of something, mm-hmm. I would want them to know that I was immediately identifying with where they were.
Right.
Their point of view.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think... I guess identification, and there are different ways to do that, but that's a good point. To show that you have some empathy or have identification with them.
The other stylistic thing that borders on content that's different from much of what we learned in school, anyway, at least the way I learned it in school, in newsletters, brochures, and letters and bulletins, etc., the thing that's I think the mistake that I often see is that the most important information is buried in the second, third, or fourth paragraph. After you've written something, it's helpful to go through and read it again and say, what's the most important piece of information? And to put that in the first or second sentence. And then everything else follows up. In news writing, it's called the so-called inverted pyramid. And you write down to the point. The most trivial part of the story is always the last item, which is very different from fiction, certainly very different from mystery novels.
How about repetition in there of your main point?
I think it's very good. Yeah.
Over again, all the way through.
Yeah. When we write fundraising letters, we say that if you haven't asked for the gift three times, you've got to go back and rewrite. But certainly in a news story, if you've got a major point, that it should go in there two or three times. Certainly if you're trying to persuade somebody to do something, to repeat that. There's two reasons for doing that. What are they?
To get the idea embedded in their brain.
Right. The second one is that most people don't read sequentially. So most people skip all over a... most people will start here and read the first 50 words. About 80% of any readership is 50 words only, and then they stop. And they say, well, I've read enough. I'm not interested, or I've got enough information. And they stop. Then those that have read the first 50 words and say, this is interesting, a large majority of them go down to the bottom and read the last part to see where the end is. What's the point of all of this? And then they will skip around in between and letting their eyes light just wherever it is, almost by fancy. Think about the next time you read a newspaper or any magazine, how you go about reading it. How do you read it? Sure.
You would want to repeat your main point?
Yes, you have less space to do it, so you have to be very careful. You may only get two times as opposed to three. Who reads magazines here? Do you read? How do you read them? When you first get the magazine in the mail, what do?
I scan it. I always look at the table of contents.
Uh-huh. You just page through it, right?
Right.
And what happens?
If I find something that I like, I'll go back to it.
Right. You either stick your finger in it.
Right.
If you really are interested, what do? You stop and read it.
Right. Yeah.
The other thing most of us do is tear out the cards and throw them out.
Yeah, we use
them. Use, yes, you use it.
What do you mean 80%?
Okay.
Well, you mean of the pyramid? Yes.
That's right. I'm not somebody that's being freshly charged.
Oh, yes. Sorry about that. Yes. Yeah. You're part of the 80% that they're trying to cultivate so you become 20%. She's talking about the 80-20 principle, that 20% give 80% of the money, and that you pay most attention to the 20% because they're going to give you the most money. Let's talk about the important point that Susan raised. Yes, please.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
It has nothing to do with this, but you know, I get a lot of letters, investment.
Mm-hmm.
Subscribe to this investment service or this or that. Or
right.
And there are 10, 12, 15 pages in length of solid copy.
Yes.
Do they work? They must work.
Oh, yes, they do.
Or they would never be sending things out like this.
Right. What is true of fundraising is true of financial investments. The people who read fundraising letters are the people who read fundraising letters. That's whom you're interested in. The 1-2 or 3% of people who are going to read the 12 pages and make the $10,000 investment. They don't care about the people that throw it out. What they really care about is the people that are interested enough to read.
Even that much?
Yes, and it's tested. I mean, it's tested again and again. In almost every test, a longer letter works better than a shorter letter. My goodness, they're asking you to invest $10,000. If you're interested, you really want to know all the details. And you want to think that it's serious. I mean, that's the other reason. This is no fly-by-night operation.
Yes, again.
Okay, let's talk about what we can do in terms of the design of our publications to make them easier to read. The most important thing you can do in terms of design is to put your name, address, and phone number. The most common mistake, especially in church-related or nonprofit publications, is I don't know how to get a hold of these people. They're telling me about this wonderful place called Holden Village. Where in the world is it? How do I get a hold of them? How do I write? Or fundraising letters that ask for a gift and then they have a response card and they don't even say where, and you somehow you've lost the envelope, you don't know where to send your check, or you're so enthused that you want to call and give them $1 million, but you don't have any phone number to call. So my rule of thumb, if it's a newsletter, that should be repeated at least twice in the publication someplace, so we know where that. The other thing is the date. One of the things that people will choose about whether or not to read your thing is whether it's old news or new news, whether it applies to them, and we all work by date. In newsletters, those are called folio lines. In most publications, every page or every other page has what's called a folio line. And here's a good example of a publication without any, Lutheran Peace Notes. So I've lost this. And here's all I've come across. And Holy Land is home to the Palestinian Christians. This looks interesting. Where is it from? Let's see if Holden newsletter has folio lines. Yes. It says Holden Village, Spring 1989. Tells me what page it is, etc. So I feel comfortable. I know right where I am. I'm doing these in order. The other thing that will ensure readability is type size. Does anybody know what the optimum type size is for the maximum readership?
10 or 11.
10 or 11. Very good. And I used to know these percentages by heart, but for every point size, and this is typewriters are in elite type is 10 point and Pica is 12 point in general. But for every point smaller that you get, 8 or 9 point, you lose, I think it's like 30% readership, because most people won't read.
And then it is bigger, what
happens? Well, you reach an optimum size, 12 to 14 point. Most body copy or copy can't be larger than 14 point for some reasons that we'll allude to later on. Does this make sense? Okay. Why is this the case? Right, there's strain. Let's see, you have glasses, you have glasses, I wear glasses.
Do
you, you have contacts. Dan? Yes? Okay, we out of this room. And John is the youngest of us.
Ron?
I'm sorry, Ron. That, and as we age, and readership goes up with age, and so therefore the people most likely in this room are people who have eye problems. I know that Ron. The next thing that indicates whether or not things will be read is type style. Here we go. Here's a good example. This is written, it's a Gothic typeface. And one, I used to, when I was more dedicated about these things, my mission in life was to go around to all secretaries and ask for their Gothic typeface balls and stamp them out.
It's what we have here, though.
The style that's read most often is called a book style. And for a typewriter face, that's Prestige or Courier. And for most typeset copy, it's Century is a popular one. Times Roman is another popular one. English School Book is another one. It's the thing with the serifs. There's sans serif, and here's serif, these little feet. And what the eye uses these little feet, and if you look closely at type, it's thick and thin. And it uses those shapes, because we're reading so quickly and so subconsciously, we use those shapes as signals to swallow or to absorb those words. And with that Gothic typeface, everything looks alike. So there's no heaviness, no lightness, there's nothing to distinguish. The other item that Susan alluded to is that most people will not read a paragraph that's more than 7 lines long. And so you say, but this is a paragraph. Well, most copy editors or most editors will say, so what? We're going to create a new paragraph. Because they know that people won't read more than 7 lines. The other thing that's important about paragraphs is that they are indented. The reason for the indentation, what do you think it is?
Signal.
Yes, it's a signal. The reader's eye is pulled into the paragraph. It finds this little place to rest and says, phew, I've got a place to start. It catches your breath. The other technique that's used is called a drop cap. Let's see if there's any examples in here. Yeah, we use drop caps in our publication, these initial capital letters that say this is the place to start. Again, it has the same impact of dropping down and pulling you into the copy.
What about just space between the paragraphs but no in
there? That's less useful because, again, you don't have a place to pull in. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to use drop caps in at the start of every paragraph.
Right.
Secretarial schools teach people to have flush left. You know, this old way of looking modern and stark and simple. But most of us don't like modern, stark, and simple. There's not a whole big market out there in glass box houses, because we feel more comfortable with this. I don't think it matters anymore. I think it's something that's changed. I mean, all of this stuff has changed over time, and I think that we've become much more used to the what's called ragged right as opposed to justified. And certainly if your justification creates gaps, you know, so you've got one word here, and one word here, and you've got... I think that looks stupid. That's harder to read than...
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It depends, too, I think, on the size of the column.
Right.
The wider it is, you can have ragged.
Right. How wide should columns be? Does anybody know? Pardon? Depends on how many words there are. It has to do with type style, I mean, it's type size. But in general, you're looking for 5 words on average. So whatever width will give you 5 words is acceptable. Now, some places you can go up to 7 or 8 if you have lots of interesting copy. And for example, most newsletters use a 2-column format. I would say in general that this type size is too small and there are too many words. Infantata 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Why is this so, what's magical about that?
It's an odd number.
It's an odd number. That's true. And 5 words, the average American or the typical semi-educated high school or educated American can swallow 5 words at a time. Our eye can see 5 words and comprehend 5 words. More than that, we get lost. Pardon?
Is that number going down or going coming up?
It tends to be fairly stable at this point. I think it's gradually increasing as our population becomes more literate, but the countervailing tendency is that as we become more literate, we're reading more. And so it puts a premium, especially on those of us who are working with nonprofit organizations or church organizations, where we're really against the stream, if you will. We have to make sure to go to extra links to make our work easier to read. The other thing, and then we'll just stop and look at some of these. The other most important thing that you can do to help your reader, other than those items up there, is the color of ink you use and the color of paper you use. Which colors have the highest readership, do you think? Yes. Black and white has the most readership. Why is that? The contrast is the greatest. Now, there are lots of other good colors, though. The problem with black and white is that it's boring as can be. And so there are some other good colors. Ivory or cream is a very nice color. Let's see if we have any. Gray is a very nice color. Both gray and ivory are earth tones, and most of us feel very comfortable with earth tones, and we still get good contrast. Let's see, here's this. Here's a good use of color. Only the biggest words are in blue. This is an ivory paper. The rest of it's in black. It's actually quite readable. It's a nice little pamphlet. What about this? It's very hard to read. As the eyes get older, pastel colors have a very disruptive impact. So the pastel greens, the pastel colors make it difficult. Pastel blue is very difficult. Here you've got this purple, which is a very difficult color to read. Here's, again, another cream color, black ink, with some brown accent colors. this is another good principle. If you have two colors, the second color is the accent color. One of the major errors that most people use, if they go to, they pay all this money for two colors and they think, my goodness, I'm paying extra to use a second color, I better use it. And so they try to say, well, we'll use half of it in one color and half in the other color. And most of the time, the eye just gets confused. It doesn't know what's important anymore. So the accent becomes an accent color.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know if you see anything along those lines.
Yeah, bright colors aren't bad. I think my favorite selection for a second color is red.
Oh, really?
Because it's bright. Yellow is a very good paper. Black on yellow is very bright. Yeah.
Red for the paper color?
No. Red as the ink color.
Yeah.
I'm talking, they always use black ink, but
yes,
it's always just almost neon.
Yes.
Colored paper.
Yes, there's a lot of that. Boy, I've been up here so long, I've forgotten what that's called. There's a name for that.
That bright.
Bright.
It's used in packaging a lot too.
Yeah. There's a technical term for it, I forgot what that is. Right.
Astro
bright.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Astro. And we use that sometimes, like that purple one you held up mm-hmm. there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if that's all we have and very little print, we use a brighter color so that if it's lost on your desk, you can find it real quick.
Yeah, I think it's
not
great.
For a lot of print.
Yeah. It's good. Let's just take some time to look at some publications. Let's take a look at Holden Village. They used a photograph. This photograph is used fairly well, except I would have cropped it tighter. General principle about photographs is look at it, define the interesting parts, and then crop it even tighter. In general, you want to crop photographs of people above the belt. In photographs, that's the interesting part. In fact, the most interesting part is the face. And so one of the deficits of this publication is that we are on page 3 and we haven't seen any pictures of people yet. Here's a nice photo of two guys. And the problem is it could have been cropped even tighter. They wanted you to get this house in there, but it wouldn't have hurt to crop it even tighter. Every millimeter or every partial inch helps make the photo larger and helps draw the reader into it. Here's a nice photo of 4 or 5 people. In general, you don't want to go above 5 people in a photograph unless there's some sort of special reason to do that. Here's a great photograph. Don't you want to know who these people are? See, they got expressions on their faces. It's a nice cropping. It's cropped tight. You just... Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
When you have, like, you showed that middle page there with all those photographs.
Yeah.
Is it best to put them all together like that, or is it better to intersperse those with text?
Well, it's a nice essay, and people are going to read it. There should be one dominant photo when you're doing that. One photo that sets the theme. And here, there's been a tendency to use all the same size, or two sizes.
So you're saying one should be...
Yeah, one of these should be the most important photo. It says, "What winter brings snow, guests, new ideas." What's the best quality photo that says that? And let that be the focal point. And then people will read around it. It's sort of like Oreos, you know? You eat the middle first, and then you...
So it doesn't matter if it's all together like that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Here we have rehab work plan for mine tailings. Not a bad headline. This is another fundamental mistake that's often made in publications. The coupon should go on the bottom right. It should never get tucked in. We're working on subconscious level with so much of this. I want to tear this coupon out, and so I have to cut this matching grants enhanced giving. Somehow it doesn't feel comfortable to us to cut across. Now, the second best place for a coupon is on the left corner if you want to. Then again, you feel you've done that. Good question. Let's look at a page. In general, people go in a Z. They start here and they go down and then they go to the bottom. That's the way the eye will look. So they'll read the headline and then they'll see what's at the bottom. This is the so-called double spread. Again, it tends to be a Z again and then going back up here, except some people will make, they'll start here and go here.
And really read one page more than another? Or is it pretty?
It's pretty, it depends on what's the page. In general, people look at the photographs first on a page. Then, secondly, they'll read the headlines. And then, thirdly, they'll read the first paragraphs. And so, what is often done is to put photographs in places where they're, sometimes put a photograph here and here. Or if you want the reader to exit, you'll put the photograph here. But you try to look in the places of the Z and find out where you want to attract readership or where you feel readership will be weakest. The other good thing about this is that there are cut lines because you've got this photograph, then people will look and they do want identification. One of the most frustrating things to readers is to have photographs without any description of what they are. And they will say, this is obvious, this is a mountain in Holden. But it's obvious, but it's not what the reader wants. The reader wants some sort of completion. Tell me what this photograph is. What's special about this photograph? Let's take a look at this one. City Lutherans in Action. One of the things that's wrong about this, I think, is that everything is centered. It becomes very static. And so the reader is bored before she or he even starts. I wouldn't tend not to do that. Let's look at some other things here. Here you can see this Lutheran Peace Notes. Here we have a headline up at the top of the Z, and a photograph over here, which is good. Here we have this issue focus on the. My intuition says to put that over here, because that's where the reader is going to exit. And do that. Are we at lunchtime? Yep. Good. Let's take one more example and then we'll let it go here. Okay. Let's take this one. Here we have a two paragraph. Again, we have centered heads, which I think are very dull. Prison Members for Justice Call for Action. Pretty dull. Again, center. And here, the artwork is buried here, which doesn't make sense to me. The best place always to have that kind of spread, the photographic spread, is in the center where there's no seam. The